The following was recorded at 4 p.m. Eastern Time.
When conflict has positive outcomes, in Ukraine, the war has given the country a fresh look at cleaner energy. When the Russian military knocked out power there, this school with solar panels showed what a greener future could look like.
Our school was able to function nonstop. There were in-person classes during winter, during blackouts.
I'm Marco Werman. Also today, 75 years ago, Jamaicans came to England to build new lives and rebuild a nation.
They came expecting to be welcomed into because this was the mother country. What they got when they got here were people who didn't want them.
And we remember Chef Ramsay, a Lebanese celebrity chef who brought calm and comfort and great recipes to millions across the Arab world.
He was my favorite, first thing in the morning. When I used to wake up and I used to follow him all the time.
Today, you're on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. Thank you for joining us on this Thursday. Another worrying sign with the war in Sudan. The United States is walking away from peace talks in Jeddah, Saudi Arabia. The State Department's top diplomat for Africa, Molly Fee, said, quote, "The format is not succeeding as we want it." A three-day ceasefire ended yesterday. Like all the previous ceasefires, the violence in Sudan did not let up. Alex DeWall at Tufts University has been following the situation in Sudan closely. Alex, help us understand what's been going on diplomatically in the lead-up to the U.S. decision to quit talks about the possibility of peace in Sudan. What had not been working with the format, as Assistant Secretary Molly Fee said?
Well, the war between the two warring factions of the Sudan Army and the Rapid Support Force paramilitaries broke out on April 15th. And about a week later, the U.S. and diplomats from Saudi Arabia convened delegations from the two sides for talks in the Saudi city of Jeddah with the aim of achieving a ceasefire and humanitarian access. And repeatedly now, over a period of 2 months, the two sides have sort of tentatively agreed, yes, we'll do something of a ceasefire, something of humanitarian access, but it has never worked. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is that each side remains convinced that it can land a knockout military blow on the other. The other reason is that actually the strategic competition between the two is not really on the battlefield. It's in the arena of resources. How are they going to be able to finance their war efforts? And unless you can actually bring the financial issues, the material resourcing of the war to the negotiating table, the two sides are simply not going to agree. They're going to regard the negotiations as a tactical arena while they prepare, rearm, remobilize for another fight.
So how do you interpret the State Department's line that the format in these peace talks is not succeeding? It sounds like it's really more on the generals.
I think it is basically down to the two generals, General Al-Burhan of the army and General Mohammed Hemeti of the RSF, and their respective venality and brutality. However, what I think the U.S. diplomats didn't get right was they focused too much on this immediate ceasefire. And what they missed out is the bigger picture in Sudan. The majority of Sudanese who are civilians do not support either of these two parties. And they are still there on the ground, still doing their best to resist and provide local humanitarian aid and so on. And if those civilians were empowered by being recognized as really the legitimate government, the legitimate power in the land, and perhaps given control of key institutions such as the Ministry of Finance or the Central Bank, then the generals would begin to see that they are actually not the sole players. They are not actually the veto holders over a political settlement in the country, and we might see a different dynamic unfold.
So the U.S. and Saudi Arabia are brokering these now moribund peace talks. How important is Washington's participation?
Washington has been quite key because it really has leverage, particularly when it comes to economic sanctions. It can impose targeted sanctions on the business empires of the contending factions, and it has done that. But bear in mind that sanctions are just a tool, and a tool for what? And I think what we're seeing now is a possibly more promising approach led by the Kenyan president, William Ruto, with three other African leaders stepping up and saying they want to fold all the issues of Sudan, not just the war, but also the questions of democratization, the question of saving the state from state collapse, fold them into one bigger negotiation. And if the United States were to get behind that, then I think we could be a bit more optimistic.
So, meantime, there are these really dark reports of atrocities in Darfur by the Rapid Support Forces and their affiliated militias. Those are the rebel fighters. You mentioned Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, also known as Hemeti. He's the general leading the RSF. Is this conflict actually growing now?
The conflict is spreading in a number of ways. It's spreading geographically. The fighting in Darfur actually erupted fairly soon after the conflict in Khartoum. It just didn't get too much coverage until very recently. And what we're seeing is an appalling campaign of ethnic cleansing, mass murder against civilians by Arab militias, the so-called Janjaweed, who were notorious from the conflict in Darfur 20 years ago, which includes Hemeti's RSF. But what we're also seeing is numerous other groups getting sucked into this conflict. So there's a danger that it's going to mutate from being a two-sided conflict to a multi-sided war of all against all, which is even more difficult to resolve.
Alex DeWall is a professor at Tufts University and an internationally recognized expert on Sudan. Alex, thank you very much for updating us.
You're very welcome.
It's hard to see anything positive emerging from violent conflict, but there is at least one unexpected plus from the war in Ukraine. It's giving renewable energies a boost. Russian attacks on Ukraine's power stations knocked out more than half of the country's capacity to generate electricity this fall and winter. Widespread blackouts are over for now, but reality may prompt a speedier transition to renewable energy as Ukraine rebuilds. The world's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler reports from Kyiv.
There was a moment last year when backup generators started appearing everywhere across Ukraine, including here in front of a hotel in Kyiv.
Those massive generators start to appear as soon as massive missile attacks begin.
That's Andriy Karol with a foundation called Energy Act for Ukraine. The missile attacks meant the average Ukrainian household spent nearly half of last fall without power. Generators helped, but Karol says there were downsides.
At some point, too many of those generators came to Ukraine. We walk on the streets, it's like a street of generators.
They burn diesel, break down a lot, and aren't very environmentally friendly, Karol says.
It's about the air that people breathe. It's about the noise pollution. So I don't think it's a good option.
Karol's organization is working on what they see as a better alternative, backup batteries that are charged by solar panels. They've installed the systems at two hospitals and one school so far. I went to that school in the city of Irpin to talk with the principal, Ivan Tashnik. We spoke through an interpreter outside of the three-story brick building where Tashnik pointed to the solar panels on the school's blue metal roof.
Half of the winter, there was no electricity all across the country, and our school, thanks to this, was able to function nonstop. There were in-person classes during winter, during blackouts, where students were in classes and were using power thanks to the solar panels.
Inside the school, Tashnik takes me into a basement room where one wall is lined with batteries. These batteries are charged by the rooftop solar panels and can power the school's critical needs for 8 hours. That includes keeping the lights and outlets on in the well-equipped bomb shelter.
I just turned off the electricity coming from municipality, and the light that you're seeing here is coming from the solar panels.
Tashnik says they also have a generator, but this energy, it's free.
We don't pay for this. Nam priroda daje.
This is solar energy. We don't pay a dime for it. And this is our future.
Tashnek is not alone in that view. The Ukrainian government outlined ambitious targets for renewables last year in its national recovery plan. President Volodymyr Zelensky says the country will become, quote, a leader in building modern green energy. Ukraine's largest private power producer, DTEC, is also touting its small but growing renewables business, which is headed by Alexander Stelishiev.
Now we understand that, especially after this winter, that energy matters. And more our authorities, investors, general public understand that energy security and renewables, it's the same.
Stelishiev says all eight of DTEC's traditional power generating stations have been damaged by Russian strikes or occupation. Right now, a lot of Ukraine's wind power is sitting on occupied land, but at least renewables can be more dispersed, he says, less centralized.
For example, let's take a wind farm. You know, you have a lot of wind turbines. It's much harder to destroy thousands of turbines than destroy one thermal block. Yeah. So it's more safe.
The company recently finished construction on the first phase of a new wind farm in southeastern Ukraine, just 60 miles from the front lines. It produces enough energy to power a small city. Stelishiev says completing it amid frequent air attacks sends an important message.
We believe that our industry, our country have future, and we continue construction.
Before the war, only about 10% of Ukraine's energy came from renewables, about half the European average. I asked a renewable energy expert about this overlooking Kyiv's skyline right before an air raid siren started. We are standing on a rooftop in Kyiv, and I don't think I see any solar panels. Is that an anomaly or is that what you would expect?
Actually, it's normally for Ukrainian city not to have like solar power equipped on the rooftops, but it's already started to change.
Hanna Rutkowska works at an environmental NGO called EcoAction. After we moved to the basement of the building, she told me interest in renewables has spiked since the full-scale invasion started.
And I think that it changed because people who had money, they said, okay, I actually can give this high upfront cost, but I will have energy supply during disruption. And it's something that make my life normal. I want to work, and renewables became like this option for people.
Rutkowska's NGO is offering grants for organizations to launch renewable energy projects. It's also installed solar panels and a heat pump at a hospital outside of Kyiv.
I think that during the recovery, we will see much more these projects.
But to translate these small projects into a national energy transition, Rutkowska says the government needs to make clear whether it's prioritizing renewables over other power sources as it seeks international funding to rebuild.
We are talking a lot about it, and we see that Ukrainian government talking a lot about it. But we also need actions, and we need like clear plan and roadmap in our head what we are doing step by step.
Last night, the Ukrainian government unveiled new estimates for expanding renewable energy by 2050. This was at a conference in London where the country is courting international funding to rebuild. But there's still not the kind of renewable energy roadmap that experts like Rutkowska are watching for. For the World, I'm Carolyn Beeler, Kyiv.
The U.S. Coast Guard says the five people aboard the Titan submersible are now believed to be dead. The agency said debris found not far from the wreckage of the Titanic is consistent with a catastrophic implosion of the vessel. Coast Guard Rear Admiral John Mauger offered his heartfelt condolences at a press conference this afternoon.
Our thoughts are with the families and making sure that they have an understanding as best as we can provide of what happened and begin to find some closure.
The vessel had been on an expedition down to the wreckage of the Titanic in the North Atlantic when it lost contact with its mothership 4 days ago. Mauger called the remote patch of ocean an incredibly unforgiving environment. He thanked those involved with the international search to find the submersible.
The outpouring of support in this highly complex search operation has been robust and immensely appreciated. We're also incredibly grateful for the full spectrum of international assistance that's been provided.
The Titan's fate has raised questions about the safety and purpose of extreme tourism. The five people on board were the pilot, a French Titanic expert, a British adventurer, and a father-son duo from a prominent Pakistani family. The Coast Guard says the investigation into the accident will continue and that governments are meeting to discuss a possible further investigation. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World.
This Windrush Day, we mark 75 years since the Empire Windrush laid anchor at Tilbury Docks. Many of the young people on that.
The Prince of Wales today in a video commemorating the 75th anniversary of the arrival in England of a ship from Jamaica. The passengers on the Empire Windrush came expecting job opportunities and a better life, but they and the people from the West Indies who followed in their wake also experienced racism and discrimination. Evadne Campbell was in Jamaica just 1 year old when her parents left for England in 1960. She joins us now from South London. Hello, Evadne. Good to meet you.
Hi. Hello. Good to meet you.
So you were just a baby when your parents moved to England. What kind of connection did you have with them an ocean away?
Well, it's an interesting one, actually, because I wasn't quite a year old when my mom left. And I only found this out recently, that I was only 11 months when she actually left me with my maternal grandparents. The connection that I had with both my parents were really only through letters and parcels and gifts that came either in parcels or in barrels during the more special season. But that was the only connection that I had with them.
And at age 11, you were able to join them in England. I'm guessing that must have been pretty odd, although maybe it had the potential to be a reunion. How did you see it?
Whilst I had no connection other than through letters with my father, my mom had visited Jamaica a couple of times during that period between one and when I arrived in England at 11. So I had seen my mom, but I have no recollection of actually the flight or even who picked me up at the airport. I know it's my father and a friend of his that came to the airport to pick me up, but I have absolutely no recollection of it at all.
Yeah, memory is a funny thing. We heard the Prince of Wales in that video today a moment ago saying that the Windrush families faced hardship but also experienced joy. I mean, that leaves out a lot of detail. What does your own family experience tell us about the impact? You're chuckling there.
I appreciate that Prince William didn't have a lot of time to give things context. But having listened to it and watched the video now myself, I'm concerned that he's left out a lot of really, really serious issues.
Yeah, tell us what your own family experience shows about the impact on this generation of Jamaican families who migrated to the UK.
Well, for my own family's experience, they came in the early 60s, as you said. When they first came, my mom has recalled arriving in the UK in bitterly cold, can't find anywhere to live. You know, they shared a room with a whole host of other families. They live in a house where there were eight different families, you know, several of them sharing the same room. And jobs didn't appear to have been an issue. But the reason why jobs weren't an issue is those families that came up on that Windrush and up through to the early 60s came at the invitation of the UK government. Those people came to rebuild the UK. They came expecting to be welcomed because this was the mother country. They were all part of the British colony, came up on a British passport and assumed they were coming to the mother country. What they got when they got here were people who didn't want them. Banks would not loan them money. They eventually set up systems themselves to support each other. But so, yeah, it was not a welcome when they first arrived. They could find jobs, but as a people, they were not welcomed, not in the numbers that came.
So you left your grandparents in Jamaica.
Yeah.
I mean, that was another kind of separation. What was that like?
That was the real trauma. I knew no one else in a parental role than my grandparents, my maternal grandparents. As I've already said, and you've already explained, I was less than a year when my mom went to England. I'd never seen my dad until I was 11 and didn't know what he looked like until I got here at 11. So in all intents and purposes, the parental role, the people that I thought I saw as mom and dad were my grandparents. So that was really difficult, both for them and for myself. I was the only child at home. So for my grandparents, it's a real emotional pull for me to have left them at 11, which was such a formative time, and it's such a time where I could, and I feel now that I could have been so much more support and help for them. And so whilst it was a good time because it was a new school year and it was a time to change school, it was hugely traumatic, hugely. And I still find it quite emotional if I think deeply about being wrenched away from all I knew, family, friends. That's all I knew, to a strange country.
Evadne, the story of your family is honestly repeated today all over the globe. Parents like yours leaving their children behind to find work. I'm wondering if you can just reflect on what Windrush has taught us about economic migration and what lessons we still have to learn.
My family's story is just one of millions, and one that continues to this day for economic migrants. And I know, obviously, in America, there are the similar issues with immigrants coming in. So the sad situation is that we people are still facing the same struggles and the same difficulties that my parents faced. I think what we're celebrating in the UK today, and I love to use the word celebrate, but I think what we're acknowledging is that 75 years on, these first migrants who came in 1948, the subsequent generations themselves and the subsequent generations have changed the face of Britain, both culturally and have impacted the way we live in Britain in a hugely positive way.
I don't want to leave you without recognizing the fact that you've had a celebrated career as a lecturer and broadcaster. You've received, the Member of the Order of the British Empire from the Queen for your charity work.
Yeah.
I'm just wondering, would you classify your story as a Windrush success story, or does it tell a different kind of story?
I think with hindsight, we can all say whatever. I don't know what my life would have been had my parents not come to the UK and brought me at that stage. And all I've achieved in England, yes, it's a success. And lots of people will say that the immigration to this country is part of the Windrush generation. It was good. I know that a lot of what I've done, all the charity work that I do and did and received the award for, was really what was instilled in me by my grandparents, not what I kind of thought about or even experienced in this country. So yes, it's you could say it's a success, but I think the things for me that I consider are the biggest success of my life is the charity work that I've done and that I do now. And those were as a direct result of my earlier upbringing. I know that.
Evadne Campbell, member of the Order of the British Empire, was telling us about her own experience as a child of Jamaican migrants in the 50s and 60s, known as the Windrush Generation. Evadne, great to meet you, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
More stories from around the globe are still coming your way this hour. Stay with us. You're listening to The World. How far is too far when it comes to cloning animals? A question posed by a new documentary as scientists reflect on the breakthrough when life was created in a lab.
At that moment, you suddenly thought, God, what have we done? Isn't this just incredible? And then you think, God, what have we done?
When a South Korean scientist took his cloning research too far, that's still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. In Japan, change is in the air. Lawmakers pushed through a slew of reforms at the end of the parliamentary session this week. And notably, for only the second time in a century, Japan overhauled its laws on sexual violence. As Julia Kim reports from Tokyo, rape has been redefined as sex without consent. And a quick warning, some of the content in this story is not suitable for all listeners.
Miyuki Kaneko was 7 years old when she did something most Japanese people are still too scared to do. She reported her sexual assault to the authorities. At the time, her local police station was so small that members of the community sometimes filled in as officers. Speaking out that day scarred her for the rest of her life.
There were no police officers, so a neighbor had to deal with it. I was already crying because I was so scared. He looked at me, pointed his finger, and laughed at me.
Being laughed at triggered a second trauma. The shock of it was worse than the assault itself.
The moment I saw that, I felt devastated. And at that time, my memory of that moment disappeared.
Her attacker was never brought to justice. The law failed her, and it continued to fail her when she was abused again in her teens, her 20s, and her 30s. But now, in her late 40s, Miyuki Kaneko believes that things are finally starting to change. Kaneko is a member of SPRING, an advocacy group for survivors of sexual assault. Last week, SPRING held a press conference to celebrate a major victory. After 6 years of campaigning, lawmakers overhauled the country's sex crimes laws for only the second time in over 100 years. Japan has redefined rape as non-consensual sex. In the past, a rape conviction required the attacker to use violence or threats to force the victim into having sex with them. The onus was then on the victim to prove their non-consent. They had to show they had tried to resist or show why they were unable to. Campaigners argued that this limited definition especially punished those who responded by freezing up, a common experience among sexual assault survivors. Yu Tadokoro is a psychologist with SPRING. He says that with the new reforms, silence no longer equals consent. Victims are no longer required to prove they fought back. Guidelines have also been included that broaden the definition of rape. And the age of consent has been increased from 13 to 16. Up until now, Japan had the lowest age of consent among developed nations. The catalyst for these changes came back in 2019. That was when four sexual assault cases, including one where a father had repeatedly raped his teenage daughter, all resulted in not guilty verdicts. Public outrage followed, sparking the so-called flower demo. Japan finally had its Me Too moment, 2 years after the rest of the world. The flower demo saw survivors assemble in public spaces to share their stories while holding bouquets in a show of solidarity. It was a first in a country where talking about sexual abuse is still deeply taboo. Tadokoro says that movements like the flower demo and Me Too paved the way for these reforms by allowing victims to break their silence. A 2020 government survey found that 95% of sexual assault cases go unreported, and two in three victims never tell a soul. The overwhelming majority of them are female. Japan's sex crimes laws date back to 1907, and up until now, lawmakers have felt little need to get with the times.
We've had a Japanese conservative government for many, many decades.
Jeffrey J. Hall is a special lecturer in Japanese studies at Japan's Kanda University of International Studies.
There's very little female representation in Japanese politics, also in the leadership of the business world. So people who are making political decisions are overwhelmingly men. 90% of lawmakers in the National Diet are men.
Campaigners are already preparing to fight for the next revision of the laws. They want Japan to abolish the statute of limitations on sexual assault entirely, pointing at Britain and Sweden as examples to follow. Their ultimate goal is to go beyond a simple no means no model of consent to one where only yes means yes, and so eradicate sexual violence. For The World, I'm Julia Kim in Tokyo, Japan.
In Honduras, during a prison riot this week, nearly 50 women were killed in an especially brutal way. Officials say the violence broke out Tuesday when imprisoned but well-armed members of a gang, Barrio 18, held back guards and attacked members of a rival gang, MS-13, inside the prison. Both gangs have roots in the U.S. To try and calm tensions throughout the prison system, the Honduran government is putting its military police in charge of the facilities. To find out what that might mean, we reached out to Lester Ramirez. He's a security analyst in the Honduran capital, Tegucigalpa. Lester, what do we know about how and why this riot began?
Well, what we know is that this government has a real issue in terms of maintaining security, in terms of criminal operations, extortion, racketeering, drug dealing, and of course, violence against women. But what we didn't know is that the government didn't have control also of the prison system here. The inmates, the gang members, the criminal organizations are basically the organizations that run the prison systems here in Honduras. And this is nothing new. This has been part of the, you could say, equation for the last 30 years. This was something that the inmates were asked, you know, and interviewed later by media, knew about that this was going to happen. The women who were part of the gangs were, you could say, bullying the other inmates and telling them, you know, you have to be prepared. Something's going to happen to you. Things like that. So this was something premeditated, something planned. Everything was designed to invoke fear, not only in the prison population, but in the general population of Honduras. And of course, send a message to the government that they don't have control and that the ones who have control are the criminals that are inside, you know.
I mean, it certainly seems premeditated. We see reports of 18 pistols, an assault rifle, two machine guns, and two grenades were all found in the prison after the riot. I mean, the attacks are too brutal and violent to even elaborate. Lester, just to clarify, this is a prison exclusively for women, and the attackers and victims are all women members of those gangs. Is that right?
Yes. This is a prison that has almost 50 years of operation, a very old prison. There is very few cameras. There is very few investment in internal security. And you see women or inmates that depend on the money they have and the influence they have, they can get privileges. One of the other problems that we had right now is that when the new government took office last year in 2022, one of their campaign pledges was that they want to return the security to the civil police and leave the military out of these types of operations. But in that process, which was not really planned and very, very chaotic, what they did is, and this is something that I was able to interview a high-level police officer, he told me that many of the prison guards were police men and women that were sent from other parts of the country where they were misbehaving, they were committing also corruption and other irregularities, and they were sent as a sort of a punishment to the prisons to supervise and control the inmates. So what we have right now is bad apples taking care of bad apples.
And combined with this move in Honduras to put the military in charge of prisons now, it sounds like the country's following in the footsteps of El Salvador, a draconian roundup there, and now 67,000 gang members are in prison, many in a massive new facility. The stats are kind of stunning. Prisons in El Salvador now hold up to 2% of the country's population. Is Honduras emulating what it sees next door in El Salvador?
I think that the government and, of course, politicians are going to try to emulate this type of actions. But it's going to be very difficult to implement in Honduras. Gangs here in Honduras are more fragmented than gangs in El Salvador. When gang members are sent to the prison system, that is where they become more organized and they consolidate power and territory. El Salvador is a very small country, and Honduras has big issues in terms of controlling territory. Now we're finding that there's cultivation of coca also, coca plantations. So it's going to be really hard to keep control of the territory. And I think that's the second factor. And the third factor, of course, is the government in itself. Bukele's government.
President Nayib Bukele.
Yeah. Bukele has consolidated power, not only in the executive branch, but also at Congress and in the judicial level, and also has consolidated power with media control of civil society and other opposition groups. So the government doesn't have that type of characteristics here in Honduras. It's a more weak government. So it's going to be really, really difficult to emulate or at least to provide or have the same results that Bukele has.
Lester Ramirez is a security analyst and consultant in Tegucigalpa, Honduras. He's been speaking with us about the aftermath of a deadly riot in a prison just outside the Honduran capital this week that took the lives of dozens of women. Lester, thank you for being with us.
Okay, you're welcome.
Lebanon has lost a cultural icon. Chef Ramzi Choueiri, or simply Chef Ramzi, died this weekend. He was known internationally for his best-selling Big Blue Cookbook and his popular cooking shows watched in millions of homes far beyond Lebanon. His calm demeanor made for a relaxing vibe.
He is a symbol of the Lebanese, symbol of the good taste, the good cooking. He was my favorite first thing in the morning.
Gada Richani there, she's in Los Angeles, one of many Lebanese around the globe feeling the loss of Chef Ramzi. We called up Joanne Rod in Beirut to talk about Chef Ramzi's legacy. She's a TV producer in Lebanon and runs a food blog called Foodie on a Mission. Joanne, what will you remember the most about Chef Ramzi?
Well, Chef Ramzi was not just another chef cooking on a morning show. He had this passion for food, for the kitchen, and he knew how to transmit to all homes, Lebanese or Arab, the simplicity of the food. So he was a full package, if I may say. The hat, the typical chef shape, the smile, and of course, the beautiful food he made.
Yeah, so why do you think he was so popular in Lebanon and across the region? What did he mean to his audience?
Well, first and foremost, Chef Ramzi was featured on the biggest pan-Arab TV channel in the 90s and on the most popular morning show back in the day. Also, he was the first chef to have live conversations with the audience via phone calls. While cooking his planned dish for the day, someone could call him to ask for a certain recipe.
So live engagement with the viewers and a morning show. I mean, it sounds like he was basically showing all of Lebanon what they could cook that evening.
In the 90s, can you imagine? So another point is that Chef Ramzi managed to make Lebanese and international dishes accessible to everyone. He didn't overcomplicate stuff. He kept in mind his audience, who is watching, and how stay-at-home ladies or fast-paced women could cook delicious dishes for their family.
Tell us about the kinds of recipes he liked to cook. Like, which dishes would you find in his cookbook or he'd instruct you on during his show?
Well, Chef Ramzi published many, many books, and he started from the basics of how to cut onions to the most sophisticated Lebanese and international dishes. His smile and passion for food were always there in a way to make his audience feel that when you cook with love and when you love what you're doing, there's no such thing as a complicated recipe.
Lebanese restaurants, as I'm sure you know, they're everywhere across the globe. When I lived in Togo in West Africa, arguably the best restaurant in the capital, Lomé, was a Lebanese restaurant, Le Phénicien. It's still there. Why do you think the cuisine has become so popular?
Well, Lebanese cuisine is versatile and is inclusive, so you can find everything in it, from a 10-minute three-ingredient dish all the way to vegan, meat lover, healthy, sweets, fried, you name it. But I think what made it popular is how the Lebanese perceive food. You see, Lebanese not only perceive food as what they eat, food is our heritage. It's sometimes a ritual. Every occasion has a specific dish. You gotta ask people, who do you get your recipe from? Is it from a restaurant chef or from your mom or your grandma?
Yeah, so would you say the Lebanese follow someone like Chef Ramzi's instructions when making their favorite dishes, or do they call their grandmothers?
It's a matter of generation. I think mothers and grandmothers, because they always want to perfect their skills, and there's always a competition. Well, I heard Chef Ramzi said 1, 2, 3, you know, they follow him. But the new generation and the kids, they always ask their mothers and their grandmothers for the recipe. When I founded my blog, Foodie on a Mission, I wanted to transmit this joy around food. Well, ful is a Lebanese dish, so I guess I'm hungry.
Remind us what ful is, because it's so good.
Ful is boiled beans with olive oil, lemon, and you're going to mash the garlic, and then you're going to put the ful or the beans on top, and you're going to mix them very, very well, and you top them with chopped parsley.
Served at room temperature. It's a wonderful salad, isn't it?
Yeah. And right before you eat it, you're going to cut an onion in four and you put in your pita bread, the onion, the mint, if you like it. And then you're going to dip it with the beans and you eat it.
All right. You're really making me hungry here, Joanne. Before I have to run to a restaurant, can you just maybe tell us, do you have in your mind a Chef Ramsay moment from his TV show that you'll always kind of like cherish?
Actually, I was just a kid when Chef Ramsay was on TV, but he brought some people to his show at a point. I remember one kid going there and he was showing them how to hold the wooden spoon while mixing in the pot. I took this technique and I always wished that I was one of the kids who were featured in his TV show.
That's a sweet little memory. Joanne Rad is a Lebanese television producer in Lebanon and runs a food blog called Foodie on a Mission, speaking with us about the late Chef Ramsay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
He went from South Korea's most celebrated scientist to an international pariah. In the global race to create the first viable clones, scientist Hwang Woo-suk was at the front of the pack.
Scientists in South Korea have for the first time successfully cloned a dog.
Researchers say the puppy is healthy and normal.
Hwang cloned thousands of animals.
Cow, pig, wolf, coyote, cat, horse.
But in the early 2000s, disrepute. Hwang was exposed for procuring human eggs unethically and fabricating data. He was indicted for fraud and embezzlement, and his lab was shut down. His story is a focus of a new documentary called King of Clones. It comes out tomorrow on Netflix. Aditya Tai is the film's director and producer. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you, Marco. Pleasure.
It's one of those stories, Aditya, where you recall the contours from the headlines at the time, but so gripping that it's kind of amazing that it slipped out of my memory. What grabbed you by the story of Professor Hwang Woo-suk, and why do you want to go back to it?
The starting point was very personal for me. I was at the last trimester of my first child, and I was really thinking a lot about sort of birth. And friends of mine at that time were getting a lot of these tests done, you know, in vitro tests that really gave quite a lot of detail about this unborn child. And I was looking into the kind of options that were even available with sort of IVF treatments, and that sort of set me down this path. And I came across Dr. Hwang's story, and I kind of felt like I could use his story as a template to kind of explore some of my own, you know, inner anxieties, really.
So scientist Hwang Woo-suk now lives in the United Arab Emirates, where he clones show camels for the country's royalty. It's a fascinating subplot in your documentary, taking us into this rarefied world of camel breeding in the Mideast. Hwang famously does not like talking to journalists. How did you get him to speak with you?
I mean, it took some time to really get in touch with him. Finally, when I got in front of him, we kind of had this long discussion. I said, you know, there's been a lot said about you. I pitched him saying that, you know, I kind of feel like you're in the last stage of life. And in the Indian pantheon, you kind of like have these four stages of life. And the last stage is Banvas, which is basically where, you know, a man relinquishes family life and just goes into the jungle. So I said, you know, this is your time in exile. And it's a time for you to kind of, you know, really think about your life and be honest with it and relook at it. And if you'd give me a chance, I will tell both sides of the story.
Well, despite Hwang's fame in Korea and his malpractice, there were always people who seemed to look at his work with skepticism, accusing him of playing God. One of his veterinary colleagues, Alex Tinson, explained to you the ethical tension in the work.
Does it feel like a God complex? Yes, unfortunately it does. At that moment, you suddenly thought, God, what have we done? Isn't this just incredible? And then you just think, God, what have we done?
One thing that Hwang says in your documentary that really stood out for me, he says, you can't dismiss science as being thoughtless. He says that in relation to one experiment where he was cloning a tiger, an experiment that went terribly wrong. Does that quote encapsulate his overall view of science, that it can do no wrong, that the ends justify the means?
I think so. He does believe in the power of science. And that is what I really wanted to explore. You know, there is the scientific world at large that is questioning the sort of moral and ethical implications of science and really digging deep and about any new technology or any new science that comes out. But what happens when it, you know, it's in the hands of a billionaire or a rich person, and here you have a scientist who's ambitious to sort of really test the limits of science, and then what happens, you know? So that really is what we wanted to explore.
Now, when Hwang first started getting criticized and exposed in Korea in 2005, there were thousands of people in Korea who vehemently supported him, actually protesting at a news station that had done an investigation of him and the veracity of his research. I mean, these people were outraged at the way Hwang was being treated. Someone in your doc compared his fame at the time to be even greater than that of the boy band BTS. Why do you think people were so passionate about defending Hwang when the evidence against him was emerging and so strong?
I think, like anything, it was mired in a lot of things. It was mired in patriotism, number one, and also this amazing hope that science was able to give average South Koreans. And here you're talking about, you know, people in rural areas, farmers who had no idea what a blastocyst was. And suddenly they are aware of it and were discussing it even in villages. And I thought that was profoundly powerful in some way. And I think everybody was so invested in the success of this that you really didn't want to believe that it could be wrong, I think, you know.
Going from heroic in South Korea to, we see a scene in which he goes back home to Seoul, and it's almost like he's going there under shadow of darkness. You know, he doesn't want to really see anybody. He sees one man. But, I mean, how do you think your documentary is going to resonate inside versus outside of South Korea?
I think everybody's a bit nervous about how it's going to be viewed in Korea. It's still a very polarizing scandal in Korea. In fact, every time we said we were going to do a documentary about Dr. Hwang, all doors pretty much shut on us, even including archives. We were unable to get archives released from national broadcasters because they just didn't want to deal with it. It's not something they wanted to really introspect about.
Are they trying to erase history almost? Is that what's going on?
I think it is shame, you know. I think in Asian cultures, shame is the thing to avoid. Why bring it up? That was a question that was asked to me recently. And I said, you know, I kind of feel like the story, even though it is a Korean story, it's the consequences are global. And what it talks about, the sort of ethical and moral complications of science, is a global issue. It just doesn't belong to Korea. And I think that's why I really wanted to look into it and give it a global perspective, really, you know.
Well, at one point in the doc, Hwang says most people see death as when the brain and heart stop working. That's the way most of us see it. He thinks death is when there are no cells left to be potentially cultured. What does that idea reveal to you about Hwang's mindset, his whole worldview?
You know, when we first thought of this film, I know it was the science was what really brought us into it, but what really we wanted to dig deep is, you know, when science reaches this point where we really don't have to think about these very human afflictions of death and grief, then what happens, you know? And he, in some way, kind of, like I said, really believes in the power of science and in some way leaning into this kind of Buddhist idea of reincarnation, which is, you know, in sync with, it's in sync with the sort of Buddhist idea of reincarnation in some way. So it kind of feels like it's justified in his head.
Mm. Filmmaker Aditya Tai, his new documentary, King of Clones, about the rise and fall of scientist Hwang Woo-suk, drops tomorrow on Netflix. Aditya, great to chat with you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Marco.
The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris Studio at GBH in Boston and the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Be safe, stay strong, and thanks for listening.